next talk by Steve Fuller. Steve is August Comte Professor of Social Epistemology here at the University of Warwick. He studied history and sociology at Columbia University, then moved on to study the history and philosophy of science at Cambridge, did his PhD in the history and philosophy of science at the University of Pittsburgh. He published, I think it's hundreds of articles and book chapters on a wide range of topics, but he's probably best known for his social epistemology and his work on science and technology studies. More recently, he's published a couple of books on Humanity 2.0 or transhumanism. And the latest of his 24 books are Knowledge, the Philosophical Quest in History, and Academic Caesar, University Leadership is Hard. And okay. I just learned that currently he's working on a book on post-truth, and we're really excited to have him here today to talk about whether academic knowledge is a public good or has to be made one. So,
okay.
That's Steve
Fuller. Well, let me thank Johannes for inviting me to speak at this thing. This is going to be a somewhat different talk on a somewhat different topic, but nevertheless having something to do with the issue of value and evaluation. Because it is very widely promoted, especially among academics, that academic knowledge is a public good. And seems to me patently it's not, in any kind of empirical sense. And so the question is, how do we square the circle of this, okay? And what I want to do is I want to begin by saying something about how I get into this topic, okay? Because when we say that, you know, when we worry that academic knowledge is not a public good, what we're usually talking about, and I think correctly, is talking about that the sense in which there that the access to the knowledge is not public, in the sense that there are access costs, and maybe even there are access costs to, as it were, to acquire it and use it, but there are also entry costs in terms of people wanting to actually get involved and potentially change it and direct it, okay? So there are all these kind of costs that are there at, you might say, both end of the production and the consumption end of the process, which prevents academic knowledge from being a public good. And when we talk about this, especially nowadays, I think, the context in which we normally think about this proposition is in terms of the commercialization of knowledge. But this is not what I want to talk about, actually, because I think the problem is much more endemic to the academic culture, okay? And in this regard, I think, what we want to talk, in a sense, if you want to get a sense of where I'm coming from on this, part of my earlier work in social epistemology, as was mentioned in the introduction, had to do with a critique of Thomas Kuhn. Okay, and you're familiar with Thomas Kuhn. And I want to talk about aspects of his view of knowledge, of science in particular, that are kind of relevant to this problem. As you know, one of the things that Thomas Kuhn believed is that you do not actually have a properly constituted science unless you have a paradigm. And a paradigm is basically when the people who are involved in the inquiry are in full control of the inquiry. Okay? So in other words, it's a kind of self-containment, a kind of self-organization, and a self-direction of the way in which the knowledge goes. And this has to do with having a common theoretical framework, having some common methodologies, a common set of problems, and some of those problems have already been solved, so they serve as exemplars for how other problems get solved. And the thing that's very interesting about this, if you look at this as, you might say, a kind of an economic proposition, is that it's a very path-dependent thing, right? In a sense, paradigms, in a way, get their legitimacy from the re-entrenchment and continuation of a kind of anchoring effect at the beginning from the founding member of the paradigm. So when we talk about paradigms in science, we usually have names attached to them, right? Newtonian paradigm, Darwinian paradigm, right? And there's a sense in which there's this kind of anchoring proposition, and then over time what happens is you get a greater sort of technicalization, specialization, refinement, and so forth. And on Kuhn's view, and this is kind of the punchline of this, right, that the only legitimate way in which a paradigm can change, the only condition under which you have a scientific revolution, in his sense, is if it self-destructs. right? In other words, the paradigm is given a monopoly over a domain of knowledge until it no longer can maintain it on its own terms. So that's a kind of absolute control. Okay, we're not talking, and this is why in the 1960s there were these famous debates that some of you may be familiar with between Kuhn and various followers of Karl Popper. Okay, because for Karl Popper, right, the idea is science is always open to criticism, it's always open to alternatives, it's always open to all sorts of other possibilities. Whereas with Kuhn, it's this very kind of focused thing, very path-dependent kind of thing. Now, that's not the formula for a public good, okay? But nevertheless, that is kind of the way, you know, even though Kuhn himself was talking primarily about the physical sciences, this has been a kind of template, respected more or less by all kinds of fields that have pretended to the name of science, not least social science, who in fact, social scientists count for the majority of citations to Kuhn these days, okay, in terms of how in fact disciplines are to be organized. And what we're talking about, what basically the Kuhn model gives you, is a kind of model of academic rentiership from a political economy standpoint, right? In other words, how to sort of secure a domain of property and then charge rents for people to enter into it. And those rents are being charged at the level of the kind of education you need to, in order to contribute to the field, and also the education you need to even read the stuff in the field. Right, so there's a sense in which, and the peer review process is the ordinary policing function of this rentiership that exists within academia, okay? You don't get a public good out of this, okay? Now, one of the reasons why I said at the beginning of the talk that I wasn't that fussed about commercialization of knowledge is because I think, in a sense, this problem is a much more fundamental... In a sense, academia is not at the level of capitalism, really. We're still at the level of feudalism, right? And to a certain extent, this is, of course there is academic capitalism in the sense that, academic research is being motivated by all sorts of external forces, and in that sense, it's breaking down the Kuhnian picture. Right? So in other words, the scientists are no longer self-determining, but they're being determined by external forces. But within academic culture, what the academic culture itself is defending is feudal. Right? So in other words, the kind of normative structure of the knowledge we produce is not that of a public good, but it is rather that of property ownership that is then hereditarily transmitted, not biologically, but transmitted through students. Right? And I don't mean students of the undergraduate sort who do not go on to do what we do, I mean the students at the PhD level. Right? So you have a lineage, you have these schools, right? You have all this other stuff, right? That is very characteristic of the social structure of academic knowledge. And this is feudalism. Right? This is academic this is feudalism, and interestingly, despite all the lip service given to the idea of academic knowledge as a public good, we in fact are defending a feudal normative structure. We are not even capitalistic. Because if you were capitalistic, given this kind of view, you would try to break this down, right? And so if you know anything about classical political economy, even before Marx, and this is one of the things that Marx actually liked about classical political economy, was that it was actually hostile to rentiership. Because what happens is when you've got people who, through hereditary means, can kind of control the rates at which access to their property is given, then you in a sense, you're potentially stifling productivity, right? Because the land could potentially be used by other people than the people who currently own it. So there should be some way, and some sort of market-based way, on which people can then get access to that land to do something more productive than the people who currently own it. There should be some kind of incentivization. Society should be organized in a way to allow, actually, that kind of exchange to take place. And that's the way in which, in fact, capitalism destroyed feudalism, was by breaking down these kinds of blockages and bottlenecks that there was in the transmission of capital in society. Okay? Now, academia is, to a certain extent, you might say, the commercialization of knowledge in the academy does a little bit of this, actually. Right, insofar as it makes the sort of the disciplinary hierarchies harder to impose and all the rest of that kind of stuff. To a certain extent, the commercialization of knowledge actually sort of functions as a kind of radical liberal intervention, you might say, into the academic feudalism that would otherwise exist. But of course, it is done very unsystematically. It is done in ways that are, in fact, very much biased and towards all sorts of interests that aren't necessarily promoting what one might call the public interest. Okay, but it is, in a way, breaking down some of that feudalism. So then we have a question before us, right? Insofar as academics wish to, you know, as it were, take seriously the idea that we're in the business of producing public knowledge, okay, then we have to think about what exactly that entails and how we would go about doing it within the academic knowledge system. And so the first thing I want to say is that making knowledge a public good isn't, that there are certain things that should not be confused with. One of them is just simply publicity. And so very often, you know, open access. Okay? So we've got all these journals now that are very free to access, right? But these journals are still written in the same incomprehensible way as they've ever been written. So there's a sense in which, you know, this obviously benefits academics who already know how to read the articles, but it doesn't necessarily benefit anyone else, right? So the whole idea of open access, I mean, open source would be a different matter. Okay, if we were talking about open source journals where one could rewrite the articles that are already there in some kind of sense, that would be a little more interesting, and that would be closer to the idea of a public good, it seems to me. But insofar as we're just talking about public access, we're just basically, talking about the people who already know how to access the knowledge to be able to access it less expensively. It's not a public good notion, right? What it's doing is it's facilitating the default position of academic knowledge production, which is as a club good. Right? A club good. That is to say, a good where, you know, where there are advantages accrued to the people who are already in the know. And so they have, as it were, paid up. And they've paid up through their education in various ways to get access to this. And of course, you can then make it cheaper from a financial standpoint for those already in the club to get access to the club good. And for me, that's pretty much what open access ends up boiling down to. Okay? So there's that issue that should not be confused with. We shouldn't be just talking about publicity. But also equally, and this is certainly a controversial in the political context in which we live in this country, is that a public good should not be assumed to be something that can only be produced through state intervention. Okay, because in classical notion of public good from the, you know, post-war period in the late 1940s, Paul Samuelson, right? Part of the idea of the very concept of public good within economics had to do with this idea of market failure, right? That within capitalist economies, certain kinds of goods will not be produced on a regular basis, and so in a sense, you need the state to go in there and to guarantee through its own explicit funding and structuring and so forth that these goods will be produced. And so there is a tendency, I think, as a result of this kind of line of thinking that comes from welfare economics, to think that you can't really have a public good unless it is state-funded. Okay? But in fact, it seems to me this may be a historical accident. In other words, with regard to the welfare states that existed, you know, in the post-war period, and given their relationship to the existing market economies, it may indeed have been necessary for the state to get directly involved in order for various things to be produced as public goods. But it doesn't follow in any kind of conceptual way that the state necessarily has to be involved, right? Because when we're talking about a public good, you know, from a strictly economic standpoint, we're talking about a good that basically it would cost more to restrict than to allow access to. We're talking about would it be more expensive? And then the question becomes, what is your balance sheet? What is your accounting system where you're talking about what's more or less expensive for a society? But the point is, would it be more expensive to actually restrict the flow of knowledge than to allow the flow? That is basically the bottom line notion of a public good. How you actually get that in terms of particular institutional structures seems to me an open question. And that the state doesn't necessarily have to be an agent. I mean, it obviously has been a very important agent in the past, but it's not clear to me that you have to have a state to have public goods, okay? But what you do have to have is a kind of determination to think that, you know, there is a problem if knowledge is not generally available to people. And you have to address that problem somehow in some kind of systematic way. That seems to me what you need to have, okay? Now, as it turns out, it seems to me that universities have, in effect, have been, I think historically, in the way they were conceptualized, if you go back, again, I like to go back to Humboldt. I know it's a bit old-fashioned to a lot of people. But this idea of the unity of teaching and research, right, the Humboldtian university, And what exactly does this mean in this context? And it seems to me that part of what it means, and certainly in the spirit that Humboldt presented it initially, because remember, when Humboldt presents the idea of research, of the unity of teaching and research, part of what he's trying to do is actually engage in a kind of nation-building strategy for the rising Prussia in the early 19th century, which is still a backwater place. So in other words, he is really looking for trying to think about the university in a very dynamic way. But what does it mean to be dynamic in this context? Well, on the one hand, it certainly means that you do want people pushing the cutting edge of research. Okay, so you do want innovation, you do want that kind of thing, and it was not at all clear that universities prior to Humboldt were actually dedicated to that, because I would say if you want to have a kind of stereotype of a pre-Humboldtian university, it was just basically reproducing the credential structure in the society, right? So you would go to university to become a priest or to become a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. That was the primary reason why you would go to a university. You'd be reproducing the credential structure of the society. But with Humboldt, you start to get a kind of different conception of what a university is for, and it's one that involves dynamizing the society in some way. And so research and teaching are going to have a kind of interesting new relationship to each other. But it's going to start by saying that research does push the cutting edge of, pushes the cutting edge of knowledge and the frontiers of knowledge and all this kind of stuff. We still are very enamored talking about whether we're talking about in the public realm or the private realm. But there's this other aspect to it, and it's the other aspect to it that I think is where the universities could actually operate as kind of engines for producing public goods, and that has to do with teaching, okay? And I think one of the things that, those of us who have been living through the neoliberal audit culture have seen the greater and greater separation of teaching and research as if they are two totally different things that only by accident exist in a university, right? In terms of the way staff is hired, the way people are evaluated, all the rest of it, right? They're two streams, basically. Right, and some universities are very explicit about this, having a kind of two-tier structure, often functioning as a caste structure, right, with the research people on top and the teaching people on the bottom. But this is so anti-Humboldtian that one couldn't even begin to talk about it, right? But the point in the Humboldtian model was that that the teaching side would, in a sense, remove, through the engagement with students in the classroom, remove the kind of initial advantage that, let's say, someone in the cutting edge of research would have by being able to make an innovation based on having built upon, prior knowledge in areas, having studied for a long time and so forth, right? Because if you took the kind of Kuhnian model of academic knowledge production seriously, which is a model in a sense where you're always standing on the shoulder of giants, right? There's a sense in which you're going to have to climb higher and higher in order to get anywhere in the future. Right, that this is just going to be a kind of endlessly elitist, segregated kind of knowledge production process. And that's why for Kuhn, the only salvation for Kuhn is that these things collapse out of their own problems after a while. That's why you have a revolution. But otherwise, these things just become more and more specialized, more and more difficult to get into. And so the question then is, okay, how then does knowledge become a public good, given that its natural trajectory, if you follow anything like Kuhn's path-dependent model, is to make it more and more elite, more and more specialized, higher and higher access costs, higher and higher entry costs? How do you do that? Well, it's through teaching, because teaching, you don't actually talk to your students the way you write your journal articles. Let's start with that proposition, okay? So in other words, what you do is you basically demilitarize, you might say, your knowledge, right? In other words, in principle, you're making your knowledge comprehensible to people who don't already have all the background that you have starting into this, right? So in that sense, you're able to give them what they actually need to do, right? What they actually need to know without them having had to reproduce the educational process you went through, okay? So in other words, you don't have to follow the path. You can get a shorter way to the top, okay? And what that does allow, of course, is more and more different sorts of people, including people who don't have the kind of academic background or intellectual background and things like that, to actually enter the knowledge system. So it's a democratizing process, basically, teaching from a fundamental standpoint, as long as what academics are teaching primarily is not to get the students to reproduce their jargon. Because if that's primarily what they're doing, then of course they are promoting the kind of problem that we're trying to address with the idea of a public good, right? They're just promoting a kind of an elite structure. But what we should be doing in the classroom is, in fact, to take these things down, to demystify, and make it easier for other people who don't have our background to get into it, so that the entry cost for the knowledge is, in fact, lower. And that gets us closer to the idea of academic knowledge as a public good. So in other words, the Humboldtian idea, from the standpoint of trying to produce knowledge as a public good, actually is a good idea if it is understood properly. Namely, that you grant the assumption that new knowledge is always going to be produced by people who have this kind of advanced understanding and have done a lot of work in an area and so forth. But then the issue is, when you move this to the classroom, how is that being presented to people who might enter into it? And what you don't want to do is to convey the idea that unless you're actually reproducing the way in which I actually got the knowledge, you're not going to get anywhere, right? I mean, you have to sort of break that sort of cycle somehow. You have to break this kind of idea that the only way you can get to the top of the knowledge system is by standing on the shoulders of giants. You have to, in the classroom, present the possibility that there are, as it were, quicker ways to the top, okay? And this seems to me a very distinctive kind of knowledge process that is going on in the classroom when people are teaching. And it is the knowledge process that academics do that actually comes closest to producing knowledge as a public good. Okay? And so I'll stop here and take some questions perhaps, because I think I've made kind of the main point that I want to make at this juncture, but I'm sure you have all kinds of questions about it. Okay, thank you. Yes, so, questions. You have a question? Yeah.
It seems to me, that you really rely on a Kuhnian view that paradigm indeed exists to develop your argument. It is a very important step in your argument.
I think it's an extreme version of a default view that I think is generally had within academia. So in a sense, he's just a very vivid version.
Right. So you mentioned that Popper, of course, and the Popperians didn't agree with this view. And certainly in the history of science, since Kuhn, there were many criticisms that were formulated against the Kuhnian views of paradigm. And some of them implied that, in fact, science locating paradigm is not so easy. Science is more pluralistic, in fact, revolution is problematic, that locating, just finding cases where you can really, when you have evidence that the paradigms may be found.
But we have the peer review system, right. And that's kind of the best proof that there's something to Kuhn's view.
I'm serious.
As long as the peer review system is central to academic legitimation, right, there is something to the Kuhn view.
Right. So what is part of it? And if science is more pluralistic, and if science is more about the cohabitation and fights against various notions, then what would you do?
But those people aren't interested in knowledge as a public good either, right? In other words, the people who are criticizing Kuhn's views on empirical ground basically aren't making an argument about knowledge as a public good. My premise is we should take seriously the idea that academic knowledge is a public good, and then figure out what kind of a structure would we need to have for this to be realized, and whether it can be realized within university structures. But of course you're correct that if you start by saying, well, does Kuhn's model actually capture the way in which academic disciplines operate, then sure, everything you say is true, right? But those people who point that out quite rightly empirically basically probably think that the idea of knowledge as a public good is just a fantasy. Right? I mean, that's the point, right? I mean, the people who make these criticisms, you know, there's a sense in which at some point, if it's not clear where I'm coming from here, I'm trying to take kind of literally normative assertions that academics themselves make about what they think they're up to, especially when they defend themselves, right? And the idea of academic knowledge as a public good is one that does not sit well either with the Kuhnian view or the view that criticizes Kuhn in the way you've just said. Right? Both views basically don't buy the idea that academic knowledge is a public good.
Well, if you think that the notion of, let's say, unemployment rate is produced by academic knowledge, you know, we put out there in the world all kinds of concepts through which people understand reality. Why would you not define those notions as public good?
Well, I mean, I think the thing is, though, in terms of being able to interact with them, right, I think that's the key point, right? In other words, when people read what an unemployment figure is, right, and this is where the interesting thing about the post-truth culture comes in, right? There's a sense in which people are kind of, I don't know if taught is quite the right word, but they come to see this as a brute fact, in a sense, right? That there's no point of engagement. So in a sense, their belief that the unemployment figure is as it is has to do with their trust in the academic knowledge production system that brought it about. Okay, that's not really the model of knowledge as a public good. Okay, that's knowledge as a kind of feudal system that you are operating in a kind of subordinate fashion to. And so the point about the post-truth stuff then becomes, well, if that relation falls apart because you don't any longer believe that the unemployment figure is true that the academics have produced, okay, then, and you've never had any other kind of normal interaction with the production of academic knowledge. So in other words, you've always been in this kind of take it or leave it mode where it's produced to you as a fact, and then the question for you is whether you believe it or not. Then not surprisingly, when you start not believing in those facts, you don't have any actual way of interacting with it in some kind of public fashion, right? So you end up getting this kind of mass rejection that we're seeing now of academic knowledge. I mean, I think this is kind of like a kind of rejection of what is perceived as a relatively authoritarian structure. That's the way I understand this, right? Because if people actually not only knew what the unemployment rate was, but had some way to interact, inquire about it, find out more about it, understand how the numbers were brought about, then there would probably be this less kind of oppositional kind of situation that we see today. That's my view.
Well, if you take Sarah Ego's book, The Average American, mm-hmm. where she shows how the growth of the social sciences throughout the 20th century have really given us a lot of the tools through which we think about reality.
Sure.
Like the mere notion that people can, you know, knock at our door and ask us questions that are, in fact, very private. I mean, even beyond the questioning of it, you know, she would argue, and I think many people would argue, that a lot of these categories are not questioned. Some specific, you know, the world of alternative facts, of course, a lot of it is challenged, but a lot of it is deeply taken for granted. So in fact, they are institutionalized categories that have de facto become a public good because they define what the public sphere is about.
Yeah, well, I know, but
it's not the private good. It's intersubjectively shared definition of reality.
It's not so much private versus public. It is more public versus club, having to do with who's actually involved in the potential production of it.
Yeah, but the consumption is collective.
Yeah, but being collective could be under many different kinds of regimes. Collective is just means many people have access to it in some kind of way. Okay, and that could include a market, for example. Right? That could be a way in which, as it were, collective consumption occurs, right? And you'd have differential consumption in those cases. Yeah.
I mean, I find it interesting that you're writing a book on kind of post-truth.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering if we take the implications of your arguments, whether we don't just end up with populism and a populist model of academic knowledge. Because, of course, you know, professors used to be paid on the basis of how many students take their classes. And if I think about, you know, what do I have to teach so that students, you know, I'm at the business school, would want to take my classes, they probably would not take the classes I'm teaching right now, which I'm...
No. See, I'm not advocating this. What I'm advocating, as I said in the talk, I'm advocating something in a way... A bit sort of more straightforward, but maybe more painful, is that we shouldn't take the fact that academic knowledge in its normal form is codified in a way that has so many entry costs as an unmitigated good. Okay? In other words, there needs to be an additional task on the back of that, which is something that is performed in the classroom, whereby all of the you know, all the technicality, all the references, all the kind of forbidding structures that to actually figure out would require much more time than you have the classroom for, right? That those things are removed and then the students are given actually what really matters in the situation. Because I think even nowadays, you know, people are, academics are sufficiently reflective about the fact that their fields all developed in terms of rather idiosyncratic histories, that the reason why they end up talking about certain things in certain ways, you know, because of the path dependency of their discipline, is actually not necessary to actually get the kind of core knowledge nugget that people should generally have if they're going to move forward. And it seems to me then that's the role of teaching, and that teaching in that respect is the second mode of academic production after the research mode, and they're equally important, and the latter is especially important if we want to talk about producing academic knowledge as a public good, because in the research vein, it's just a club good.
But then I don't understand how you say, you know, this can be done without the role of the state. Because, of course, in the Humboldtian idea, the model, you know, he had not, it was not a model of the neoliberal subject
that
just comes into the world and can just, you know, absorb this knowledge. But it's a kind of a Bildungs process, a process of education that people have to go through to actually get to the state where, you know, they become the types of...
Yeah, but the point about I agree, but if you go back, if you go back to this idea of Bildung, the idea of Bildung was that each student would develop in their own way, and what the professor had to do in the classroom was to, as it were, make the avenues open for them to develop in their own way. And the last thing you'd want to do then is to ram jargon down their throat, right? Because that means, that suggests that the only way you can understand something is by this way, by the way I came to understand it. And that defeats the whole purpose of Bildung, because in a sense, you know, this is what makes teaching a kind of tricky process, right? Because there's a sense in which you kind of think you know the truth and you've received it in a certain kind of way, but you've got to present what you think you know in a way that allow other people to get into it from whatever means they're coming from. So you have to destroy the path dependency of your own knowledge, right? That is what the because Bildung was about open development for each individual, right? That in a sense, and that was what made... Because it was completely the opposite of a kind of traditional notion of teaching where what you're doing is reproducing knowledge from each generation to the next generation in a kind of tradition-based sort of way. It was the exact opposite of that. So the question then becomes, how, if you have knowledge that starts off by being incredibly forbidding in terms of how you get access to it, how do you make it available to people who do not have all the background you have? So it is teaching then becomes this kind of inherently democratizing process. That's kind of what the idea was. I mean,
maybe we can collect a few questions.
Okay, sure, sure.
So there's one here.
Yeah. My question to you is this: what is your idea of expertise behind your model?
I hate expertise. I'm like Michael Gove in this respect. I'm afraid to say. I think that there is a sense in which the expertise understanding of what an academic is, it's going to be our Achilles heel at the end of the day, frankly, and we're already seeing because in a sense, the authority that academics are invested in initially, you know, when they're sort of when people are behaving the way we like them to behave, ends up being our downfall when they start to look behind things.
Yeah, I didn't ask you what's your view of experts. I asked you what's the view of expertise they got.
What do you mean?
How do you configure expertise? What differentiates between expertise and non-expertise?
I would say, I take a very kind of practical view in the matter, namely whether you can contribute to the body of knowledge you're talking about. And so then we have all sorts of issues about at what level you can actually intervene in the knowledge production process.
The problem is Colin's view of contributory.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, also include esoterism. It's a sincere question. Is that, you know, the model of expertise that I know that you...
No. See, I don't... I actually think esoterism is a sort of self-mythology. That's
my question too.
Yeah. I don't believe there's... I don't believe that there's... To be honest with you, I don't believe that there's any kind of knowledge that can be called public knowledge that actually would require someone to go through exactly the same process someone else had to go to get to it.
Okay, can we just collect...
Okay, sorry, I mean, I know I answered him directly, yeah.
There was David, Johannes, and Nordje, and one question back there, so maybe we collect the four
questions. Sure, sure, sure. Let me take some notes then. I'll do what David did.
mine follows exactly now from your answer to Davide. public good.
Mm-hmm.
The wilderness is a public good. The ozone level is a public good. Does everyone need to have equal access to all wilderness sort of to be able to say that it's a public good? Or would it might be reasonable that there should be some kind of restriction on access to the wilderness, which could be democratic or not democratic, but we would not need to have everyone have access to the wilderness at every possible moment. In fact, we could say that everyone having access to the wilderness at every possible moment would degrade it.
Yeah,
okay. So what I'm wondering is, I don't understand why esotericism might not be an aspect of the public good in the field of science. That there could be a public good that at the highest levels of achievement in certain realms of knowledge, it is esoteric. The question would not be that it's esoteric or not esoteric. And not everyone would be able to have access and immediate access to that knowledge. The question would be, are there unnecessary restrictions on the ability to be able to produce within that field?
Yeah.
Therefore, we would be able to value esotericism as a public good and be able to say the obstacle to the creation of that esoteric knowledge is produced by the differential access for people to be able to enter that field and be producers in it. Because I think esotericism is valuable. Because there are bodies of knowledge which we could not and should not expect everybody to be able to have equal access to. My brain surgeon, I don't want to have to know what my brain surgeon is doing. I want her to have an esoteric knowledge that I do not have access to, and unless I retooled myself exactly, I would never be able to have.
Okay.
Can you honest maybe?
Yeah, I mean, this idea that academic knowledge is closed, obscure, they're high cognitive entry costs, that's a great idea. I mean, it's true, it's not just that, it's a system where we have these posts, these concierge at the entry here, which keep you from getting into the building, but it's fundamentally difficult to grasp. However, if it's really about opening it up, I'm a bit surprised to see that teaching is the solution. I mean, we know that the educational system has certain mechanisms which reproduce inequalities. We've all read Bourdieu, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, isn't teaching inherently the same problem?
Okay.
I mean, you reproduce the very thing that you want to abolish.
Can I respond to these? Or?
Maybe one more question.
Okay, because there's enough on the table here already. Okay.
Three more, and then we finish.
Okay.
Your talk made me think of Alfred Schutz, the scientific citizen. Because I think there, and it might connect back to a point by Michel Lamont, that the notion that citizens have to be like experts, that they have to become mini scientists in order to be participants in knowledge culture. I mean, that was the idea that Schutz challenged in.
Yes,
that,
I know. He's not a friend to my position. Yes.
Well, but there's an important point there around precisely social epistemology.
Sure, that's right.
If we only allow the binary of either the citizen is like a scientist or else he or she must be a non-epistemic subject who is outside knowledge culture. If we only allow those two binaries, I don't think we're going to get to an affirmative answer to your question. So in terms of, you know, diversities of knowledge culture and the kind of social epistemic perspective we need in order to appreciate diversity of knowledge culture, isn't that an element of this debate that needs to.
Okay. Can I start answering now?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with the last one. It seems to me that given the kind of wave, what's been called populism, the anti-expert thing that's going on, I think we already live in a world where people see themselves as outside the knowledge system, despite all the stuff that people write about the blurring of cultures and things like this. So, so there is a kind of very big kind of political fact that's sort of out there, like the elephant in the room, that needs to be addressed. And the reason why I'm addressing the point this way is because I think I'm trying to tie this back to what I regard as fundamental academic values, right? In other words, I'm trying to, I'm not making this argument from the standpoint of some kind of proletarian science, though one could make the argument from that standpoint too. I'm making it from the standpoint of the lip service that academics pay to the idea of knowledge as a public good, and that academia is somehow uniquely positioned to do this, right? That's the other thing too, right? That the reason why universities are important as opposed to other things that actually produce knowledge is because that in some sense, we are the custodians of the public knowledge as a public good in the way in which other things are not. And so my question is then, on what basis do we have grounds for saying this? Okay? Because I think this is a nice idea, actually, and it is one that is to a certain extent rooted in the history of the university and of academia, but on what basis do we say it? And so to go to your point, you were saying about, now, I think we have to draw a distinction here, right? The way in which teaching has become institutionalized and the way it reproduces inequalities and all this stuff that you were referring to, right? This was not kind of the function of teaching within the Humboldtian model. And this is why I go back to the Humboldt. But look, the fact of the matter is, I'm going to grant you the basic point, namely teaching as it is actually now conducted and reinforced in our societies, certainly under the neoliberal regime, but to a large extent even before that, right, is not in the way I'm talking about. Because what I'm talking about here is a kind of symbiotic relation between research and teaching, right? So that teaching's primary orientation is not to the production of credentials for people, but rather to the democratization of research, okay? And that's how you could have a kind of unified academic subject, right? A teacher-researcher, right? A teacher-scholar, right? This kind of notion that people still pay lip service to. That was the idea. It was imagining the social relations between the two functions differently from the way in which we have come to imagine it, let's say, over the last 50 years. Okay, so I would grant you the empirical point, but again, the question is, in terms of trying to, if you believe that there is a problem of academic knowledge as a public good, it would be through the teaching function that you would address it, and you could recover some of the normative resources that are there to do so. Because we do still pay lip service to the idea of the unity of teaching and research. Admittedly, this would mean changing the way we audit people and monitor people, and we would have to change the fact that teaching and research are evaluated in two different ways rather than in some more integrated fashion, which would be more along the lines I would prefer. Right? But the point is, it's not mysterious. There are precedents for doing the kind of thing I'm suggesting. But it's true, we do not live in a world that's friendly to that. But what I'm saying is not something I'm pulling out of a hat. It is something that is within the tradition of academia, okay? And I'm saying, take the normative ideals a little more seriously and figure out ways to try to institutionalize it. Now, to go to David's point here, which I thought was a very interesting point at the beginning, that you could have the idea of knowledge as a public good, kind of in the spirit in which you have the idea of the wilderness as a public good, where not everyone has to be in the wilderness at the same time. In fact, if they were, this would cause enormous problems, right? And so you have to have some kind of policing going on, okay? And I think this is very interesting, and I do think that to a large extent, there is a kind of role for academia in, because I'm not trying to get rid of peer review, okay? I just believe peer review is way too important in academia, but I'm not trying to get rid of it altogether. And I do think that peer review can function in some of the way you're talking about, as a kind of policing activity in a way. I think the reason why there's an enormous amount of disaffection with peer review, even within the academic culture, is that peer review has imperial overreach. Okay, so in other words, it isn't just about correcting error and telling people you're missing out some crucial things, but rather there are judgments being made about whether research programs are worth promoting or not. Right? So there's this kind of second-order judgments that then, in a way contribute to this kind of coonification, you might say, that I was talking about with regard to academic knowledge production. Namely, if you put a proposal, right, to a funding council or to a journal, you put an article, it's not enough to see whether or not you got stuff right in the terms that you actually presented it, but rather whether this is really relevant, whether this is really important, and what is the standard? The standard is going to be certain kinds of agendas to promote disciplinary structures, to promote journals, to promote whatever. And this is where impact factors of journals become these insidious things, right? Because editors get in there and tell you, you've got to cite stuff that were previously published in this journal or in this field in order to get accepted, right? That's the imperial overreach of peer review that goes beyond the basic policing function, which I would actually think is fine, right? So in other words, I don't think everyone should just be able to say everything they want to say about anything, because that would pollute the knowledge system. I understand your point, okay? And so there is a role for peer review there, but the problem is peer review as it's currently constituted has imperial overreach. And that's where you get the anti-expert backlash coming from. So if peer review could somehow restrain itself, it could actually function effectively in this way. But you know that the problem we're facing now is the internet. And I didn't talk about that here, but the internet is the thing that's breathing down your neck with regard to this kind of idyllic notion of a wilderness that could be policed. Right? Because the internet's already putting all the knowledge out there, right? And all the so-called anti-knowledge as well, right? It's all out there. Right? And so the question would then be, could you have a peer review of the internet? Right? Because in a sense, insofar as there's this kind of externalization knowledge taking place, right, you might think that this might be a kind of role that academics, could step up to the plate about, especially if they are concerned about preserving the integrity of knowledge as a public good, in the sense you're saying, would be for academics to somehow come up with regimes whereby we could peer review the internet in some sense. Again, it's an open question how we do it, but I would have thought that might be a role for academics.
So maybe, I think I saw two more questions, one by Claude, and do you want to ask a question? Okay, so three questions, and then Julian?
No.
Mine is more of a remark. I mean, we can talk about this in longer terms, but it might make sense to distinguish the economic and moral meaning of the term good in public good, because this is one thing that becomes complicated, I think. And I mean, the discussion about knowledge as a public good is a form of actually a moral economy, because it assumes that knowledge is a good not only in the economic or political economic sense, but also in the moral sense. And it might be interesting to see if you try to analytically distinguish between the two, what you end up with.
Yeah, no, I agree, though I do think...
Can we just...
Sorry, I didn't mean
so,
to...
George,
yeah.
And one more, thank you.
That would be interesting to challenge another assumptions and see how you respond to it. This has to do with the idea that a paradigmatic science would be a rentership. And that's important in your argument.
Yes.
Argue. That's not very good. And certainly you can, I see many elements that you could use to argue that there are some rents, that paradigms create some rents. And I see that in the work of several authors that you can sew together. But at the same time, if you read my reading of Kuhn, that Kuhn doesn't really provide the tools to see a paradigm as a rentership itself, but that it's more a trap, a worldview that is a jail, a trap out of which it is difficult to escape. But then it doesn't mean that it is not public, so in a sense. So I think it's, if you take this argument seriously, then it is a way also to argue about what public means for you, in addition to your preceding arguments. And I would be curious to know whether how you would handle that, this challenging argument.
Okay.
Initiated and led by elite institutions. Uh-huh. And I myself tested the MOOC run by my colleague in Princeton University Global History Lab. And it is not just the one way. by dissemination of this elite knowledge to the public, the mass, it was a very participatory process of making a new global knowledge of history.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know your opinion about this MOOC phenomena in relation to knowledge as a public good.
Yes, okay, that's good. I'll start with you then. And we'll go in reverse order again. I've been MOOC'd, okay? So in other words, I haven't formally participated in MOOCs, but as long as you've got videos floating around the internet, you can get MOOC'd, right? So you get put in as part of a course where there are a series of different videos and so forth. And this was through Edinburgh University, and I was given like something like a couple of weeks notice about this, and I was told that students would contact me, that this is part of what their course is, to contact me, and whether I'd allow this to happen is okay. And I actually got a lot of contact, and there was a lot of interaction going on for that very brief period that they were focused on what I was talking about. It was a TED talk I had given. And so I'm generally supportive of that, okay? I think that's one way. I mean, I think, though, the thing about MOOCs is MOOCs can only be seen, in terms of the argument I'm making, they're at best a kind of device, but they're not the answer to the whole question, right? Because you need a kind of appropriate social structure from the standpoint of maintaining, you know, the university as an institution. And I think one of the problems, you know, with MOOCs in the way they are being used now is it's a bit opportunistic in a sense, right? And often seem to be in competition with traditional university forms of instruction and things like that. But I do think it is part of the solution. So the point is, I am sympathetic to them. It's just I don't think one can sort of just think about them as a kind of panacea, given the kind of more general issues involved. Because not everyone has access to these MOOCs, and some of these MOOCs actually charge quite a lot of money if you want to get some credit on the back of what's being said. And so there are all kinds of other issues involved there. But I'm generally sympathetic, so I would say that.
Your point about Kuhn. I mean, look, the point about Kuhn, and this is the thing I think people always need to understand, is that when Kuhn is presenting this picture of science as paradigm-driven, etc., he's actually presenting this in a way that he regards as positive. He doesn't see it as negative, okay? And in fact, and that's the problem, right? So that's the problem, right? He actually, so in a sense, what is kind of, I mean, again, if you go into the, I wrote a very large book about the whole Kuhn craze or whatever about 15 years ago. And I think the key thing was that, you know, what's in the background of Kuhn's model of scientific change is the idea that science is really the only form of knowledge production in society that has the kind of stability that can actually command authority amidst all the other kind of chaos exhibiting in the political arena and so forth. So in this respect, science has to stand out. It has to be organized in a radically different, fundamentally undemocratic way, right? In order to have be kind of a anchor point for society. I mean, I think that's kind of part of what the message is. And so with regard to, if you look at the social processes of science that Kuhn actually spends most of his time talking about, they're mostly about how you get in. It's about the entry, right? It's about acculturation. It's about how you learn the paradigm, right? And in other words, you know, insofar as there is real sociology in Kuhn's book, and there isn't that much real sociology in Kuhn's book because he didn't know anything about sociology. We've just projected this on him. It is about acculturation into a scientific paradigm, how you learn the stuff, right? In other words, how do you pay the entry costs? That's really, right? But that's the only true sociological thing he really gets into in any kind of detail, because there's a sense in which once you've bought yourself into it, then your mind is colonized and you spend the rest of your life basically solving all those problems according to that framework, etc., etc. Right? So Kuhn, I think, is very cognizant of the rentiership aspect of this, okay? Because he focuses so much on how you get in. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go on so long. And then finally, Jana's point about the public good. I agree. I mean, I think the distinctions do need to be made between the idea of public good as a moral good and an economic good, but I am actually quite partial to a sort of balance sheet approach to this. You know, so in other words, I do think one of the things that the economic notion of good has going for it is that you talk about benefits, costs, and so I like this idea that the notion of public good is tied to the idea that it would cost more to restrict access than to allow free access.
I like that as a kind of normative principle to hold on to, and then to think about around that what kind of a social system we're talking about that would be mindful of this kind of norm. Okay, so can I stop there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.